Hello, this is the Overtones Podcast, a show about the beauty of diversity within Christianity today. I'm Joe, and I'm a church worker.
I'm Christy, and I'm a church historian.
And I'm Lorraine. I'm a Christian teacher. On our show, we talk to academics, professionals, and full-time church workers to explore lesser-heard voices that are shaping the church today.
Okay, so the story I want to share is about my experiences trying to share the gospel with a Shinto priest from Japan. And I didn't have any contact previously with any priest from the Shinto religion. But what I learned from my contact with this gentleman, we'll call him Mr. Tanaka, is that the Japanese worldview, and particularly a worldview that's influenced by thinking that comes from Shinto, is worlds away from the worldview that I grew up with in the West, in Scotland, where I'm from. I got to meet with Mr. Tanaka most weeks for the best part of a year, and he was open to talking with me about questions of faith. We shared meals together. We also shared our stories together. And through the time that we were meeting, I got to open the Bible with him many times, and we would talk about Jesus Christ and the gospel and the Word of God. And wonderfully, through the course of a year, he seemed to be moving closer and closer to believing the Christian message. And of course, as a believer and as someone passionate about sharing this message, I got very excited about this. And towards the end of the year, he got to the point where Mr. Tanaka was saying to me, "Yeah, I believe that Jesus Christ is the creator of the world, and I believe that he is God who died for my sins." And I thought, okay, we're there.
Well, there you go.
Praise God, we sealed the deal. So I was beginning to talk to him about becoming a Christian. And, you know, I was sort of saying, well, if you believe these things, you know, this is the key. But this was where the spanner came into the works, or the jar in my worldview. I experienced the difference with his, because he said to me, "I'm not going to give up being a Shinto priest because I believe that Jesus Christ created the deities of Shinto. And for me, there's no problem in holding these things together." And I said, but you said Jesus is the creator. You know, that makes him the only God. "No," he said, "that's not how it works. I can see that Jesus has created the deities of Japan." And what I realized that he'd done is that he'd added in some way Jesus Christ to his pantheon. And in Shinto, there are proverbially at least 8 million gods, and Jesus Christ had become another one. So this for me kind of illustrates what some of the challenges and the complications of sharing the uniqueness of Christ, gospel, in a worldview that is polytheistic and also very much pick and choose in terms of what it takes philosophically, in terms of religion, faith. And this plays out through Japanese history. So yeah, this for me was a formative experience in my understanding of relating to the Japanese and sharing the gospel with them.
That's such a fascinating story. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Richard. We're really looking forward to hearing a lot more from you in a moment, but I just want to take a second to welcome our listeners to another episode of the Overtones Podcast. We're delighted to have Richard Brash joining us today to talk about the joys and the challenges of communicating the gospel in the urban Japanese context. So listen in as we continue our conversation in a moment.
Right, thank you, Richard, for your wonderful story that illustrates, I guess, the challenges of sharing the gospel in Japan. And am I correct that you are currently based in Nagoya?
Yeah, that's right. I've been in Nagoya since 2020.
Cool. I mean, how long have you been in Japan?
In total, probably about 12 years. I moved to Japan straight after graduating from university as an undergraduate in 2001. So now you've dated me.
And I wonder whether you can share a little bit about what Japanese urban culture is like. Very often we think that urban environment or like cities are all very similar, but I wonder whether you have any insights in terms of how unique or how different it is.
Yeah. No, that's a great question. So I've lived in the Tokyo area previously and Nagoya now, both of which is a big urban center. So I think if I was coming up with one word to kind of sum up Japanese urban culture, it would be transient. Mm-hmm. And you could say that about urban cultures across the world, but maybe a couple of ways in which this is a distinctly Japanese phenomenon. Mm-hmm. So first of all, it's transient in terms of population. And that's because Japan, perhaps uniquely among first world countries, is right at the top of its demographic decline. It's about to begin. Okay, so the Japanese population is expected to really drop off at a precipitous level over the next few decades.
Wow.
126 million people in Japan at the moment, but they have this phenomenon called kasochiki, which is basically vast areas of the country which are going to become effectively uninhabitable. And that's because, you know, infrastructure is just going to be unsustainable. Mm. Sewage and electricity and all these things. For these areas where, you know, the average age of people living in them is well over retirement age.
Mm.
And people are flocking still to the cities. So there is still growth in the population of Japanese cities. You know, think somewhere like Tokyo, you've got, it's the biggest population of any city in the world. So I think you're talking about, you know, 37 million people. And even here in Nagoya, depends how you measure it, the city boundaries, but greater Nagoya, between 6 and 10 million. And people flocking in, there's a sense then of kind of impermanence because so many people are new. And I think the second aspect of this transiency that I pick up living in Japan is just the buildings. You know, we live on the Pacific Rim of Fire here in Japan, and historically earthquakes have just flattened the place every so often. So Japanese people traditionally have not built buildings to last.
Interesting.
It means the cityscape is just changing all the time. I look at pictures of Nagoya from a few decades ago, and it's completely unrecognizable.
Mm.
There are old buildings here, temples and shrines. We'll talk about those later on. But even some of those, traditionally, you know, it's been the practice to dismantle them every few decades and rebuild them. Not always the case.
Mm.
What this impermanence or sense of transiency comes from is just the historical experience of having your living area and the buildings that you're involved in just destroyed or every so often.
Mm.
And it's led to this culture, I think, of not expecting even modern buildings to last particularly long, things popping up really quickly, lack of sort of civic planning, you know.
Right.
You go to somewhere like, you know, big cities in the West, and often you'll find architectural gems where buildings are all sort of made to the same kind of standard, and they've got this regularity about them, whereas Japan doesn't really have that at all. So yeah, transiency.
Hmm.
And I think, you know, the other thing is just that even in the urban centres, Japan is an extremely homogenous culture.
Right.
You know, so the percentage of foreign residents in Japan is tiny. It's like 2% or something. So I'm one of them. But, you know, basically everyone's Japanese. And, you know, I've lived in a place like London where it's just, you know, just an ethnic melting pot, isn't it? You know, people from all over the place. You know, I'm not a native to London either. So whereas Japan and maybe Nagoya more than Tokyo, you know, Tokyo does attract quite a lot of people from overseas.
Sure.
These are some of the things that shape urban culture.
That is very interesting. I think Taiwan is very similar in the sense that it is very homogeneous. It's mostly Chinese, but definitely less transient compared to Japanese cities. And I wonder whether that in some way shapes people's mentality in Japan, Richard. Like, do they then think less about, like you said, that things don't really last, like architectural buildings, things don't last. Does it come with some kind of religious understanding of what life is about?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. I think inevitably this kind of lived experience over generations where, you know, every so often the world shakes is going to affect people's culture and philosophy and thinking and so on. I mean, you see it in Japanese art and sort of higher culture, this idea of wabi-sabi. Don't know if you've heard of this, but it's the kind of idea of things that are, you know, passing away, and they have this kind of beauty to them in the dying.
Mm.
Japanese people kind of feel, the classic example is the cherry blossom. They'll be beautiful for 10 days, and then the wind blows, and, you know, they're kind of scattered around. And for the Japanese, almost as much as the sort of experience of seeing the cherry blossoms in full bloom, there's the poignancy of seeing it all, you know, drift away. So that's the transiency, that's the impermanence. And I think one of the big challenges of getting across the gospel in a culture like this is that people do, I think, live sort of more for the moment. I mean, it's a generalization, of course, but there's a kind of eat and drink for tomorrow we die kind of vibe.
Sure.
And that's not, I'm sure, disconnected from the feeling that, you know, at any moment, the rug could be pulled, a carpet could be pulled out from underneath you as the world would shake.
Very literally.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's it. I mean, you may have seen recently, just on the 1st of January, we had a big earthquake over in the Noto Peninsula and 250 people died. And you might think that that would get Japanese people sort of thinking more about, well, what's the immovable? Where's the rock on which I can stand? But that's not always the case, I don't think. It seems, at least in general, it seems to work the other way.
That's really interesting. To what extent would you say Japanese culture, especially in a city like Nagoya, has become westernized? And to what extent are there still kind of traditional values that are dominant even city life?
Again, this will be perhaps different for different people experiencing. So I can only really talk from my experience. But we probably need to go back a little bit, Lorraine, to the history of things.
Sure.
Because Japan and its contact with the West sets the context for how I might begin to answer that. So Japan really had kind of no contact with the West until the 16th century, when Catholic Jesuit missionaries pioneered by St. Francis Xavier came in and shared the gospel. And then after that, there was a period of severe persecution of the church. For 250 years, you had this period called Sakoku Jidai, like the closed country. There was no real contact allowed with Westerners, one or two exceptions. But this was followed by, in the mid-19th century, a period of what's called Bunmei Kaika, civilization as a process, you know, making it civilized.
Right.
This is a deliberate decision on the part of the Japanese government. They were kind of forced to open up the country by the arrival of the American gunboats. But once they did that, they decided what they needed to do was to stop Japan from its kind of backward past, as it was now cast, and bring in Western ideas and Western technology particularly. But what you get, and it's really interesting, you get this thing called Wakon Yosai, which literally could be translated as Japanese spirit, Western technology.
Oh, interesting.
This is a policy decision of Japanese leaders. What they're trying to do is they're bringing in the tools and they'll bring in ideas as well to the extent that the ideas have utility, you know?
Sure.
So you'll find Japanese education set up along German lines. You'll see that they model their railway on a kind of British model, and their constitution, you know, they borrow elements from American and British ideas. But it's not necessarily a total change. And this is what's expressed by this idea of Western technology, but Japanese spirit. So I think this kind of persists today. I mean, you come to Japan and, you know, it's got McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts and you think, oh, this is just America or whatever.
Right.
People learning English at school and, you know, people are not typically walking around in kimonos.
Sure.
Although some do. And you think, okay, it's Western culture, but I think the deeper you go, the more you realise it's not quite that simple. And, you know, you sort of ask what are the traditional aspects that remain? I mean, things like the collectivism, the idea of conformity is so important to Japanese culture. So the proverb is, the nail that sticks up gets hammered down. And if you're 6'3" like I am, you experience regularly being the nail that sticks up.
Oh, no.
But this is what it is. You know, the Japanese, they're often, when they're thinking about what they might do, they're very interested about what he's doing or what she's doing. Who's my group? Who gives me validation or justification for what I'm doing, because they're doing the same thing. People don't want to stand out. You know, you come to Japan and the big differences from somewhere like the UK is you're on the train and it's silent. You know, nobody's on their phone.
Oh, wow.
Because they say, don't use your phone on the train. And if someone picked up their phone and started talking, that would just be, you know, complete taboo. People don't put their feet on the seats like they do.
Right.
Because nobody does that. People don't eat on public transport because
really?
People don't like the smell. You just never see it. So there's a conformity there. It's not, as it were, policed.
Mm.
It's policed at a horizontal level because everyone's looking.
Mm.
People are very loyal to their inner groups, and their inner group might include their company, their family, the other circles they're involved in. I don't know if you've heard of the Japanese concepts of uchi and soto. So uchi means kind of like inside. Soto means outside. And this is, it's a very helpful way of explaining how the Japanese kind of manage their social relations, but everybody and everything is conceived as being either in or out, depending on your relation to it. And you can be in respect to somebody in one context, but out in respect to them in another context. For example, if they're in your company one day, but they're not in your kind of department another day, or whatever, like this, just depending on how you... But Japanese people are very, very conscious of this. So, you know, when they exchange business cards, the name of the job position is just so important, because that'll tell you who's senior,
right?
How deep you've got to bow.
Wow, okay.
So these things, you know, these are not Western things, of course, but and they're still very much there in terms of the way that social relations grow and develop, even in big cities.
I remember this must be like years ago, but I went to Japan and I was probably waiting for a train to come, and I saw that everyone dressed the same. Like, they are all in suits, black and white. All the men are carrying very similar type of bags, and they are all using a fan. And I just thought, wow, that is cultural uniformity right there.
Yeah, yeah. And it is uniformity rather than unity, I think. It's certainly, people like to look the same. And there are exceptions, of course. You can go to some of the sort of places in Tokyo where young people tend to hang out a little bit kind of, you know, fringe or whatever. And then, you know, one of the things that's changed is social media.
Sure.
The thing with Japan is when you're always conscious of who's up and who's down, and you're thinking very much in terms of inside and outside, and you speak differently depending on who you're talking to. It's various registers of politeness. So that'll involve either how much you lower yourself by using humble speech or how much you lift up the other person by using honorifics. But, you know, on Facebook or X or whatever, the playing field is kind of leveled, isn't it?
Yes, that's fascinating.
And interestingly, I know some people who on social media, they prefer to use English because they say, I've heard someone explain this to me, English is inherently a more horizontal level, because you are you, whether you're the emperor or someone who's just joined my company, you're always you.
Right.
Whereas in Japan or in Japanese, there's different ways to refer to the second person, you see?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Mm. Since we've lost thou in English, we don't have a way of distinguishing.
Yeah,
that's fascinating.
That's right. Mm.
So amidst all this kind of cultural uniformity, what's the general take on Christianity in Japanese culture today? I know that's a big, broad brush question.
Yeah, we can generalize, but in a culture that's conformity driven, generalizations have unique use, probably.
Sure.
Again, a little bit of the history. So you've got that 250 years when Christianity is proscribed, it's illegal.
Yes.
And I don't know if you've seen Martin Scorsese film Silence. It's pretty hard watching, but this is graphically illustrating the period of intense persecution in the 17th century. So you have a long time when Christianity is thought of as being the kind of religion of the foreign devils, it's evil, and so on. Fast forward, though, to when Commodore Perry arrives with black ships from America, Japan is opened up, and what you get is a lot of the intellectual classes being very interested in Christianity and converting to Christianity.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, and it's part, I think, of this civilization drive. Mm-hmm. So the intellectual class are really attracted by this. Christianity seems to have robust sort of intellectual weight behind it, philosophical tradition, and so on. A good number of them convert. And really from this time, Christianity has an image in Japan of being kind of white collar religion.
Okay.
So you need to be quite clever to understand it. That's the way people think.
Wow.
Yeah, just going back a bit, before the closure of Japan under the Edo shogunate, that early 17th century, when the Jesuits came in, lots of Japanese became Christians. You know, they heard the Jesuit message, different from what evangelical Protestants might present.
Sure.
But they specifically, the missionaries, targeted the daimyos, the feudal leaders. So there was a real kind of trickle down again.
Right.
What would happen is that the lord would convert, and then the whole village would convert. And we kind of think, well, you know, these can't be real conversions because we're Western. Well, I'm Western. I don't speak for you. You know, we think, you know, surely everyone has to make their own individual sin. But what happens is when the persecution comes, a lot of these people are martyred.
Wow.
And there are testimonies from the time of how in villages where the feudal lord is converted, this whole sort of ambience of the feeling is changed. You know, that contradicts with the 250 years of Christianity being prescribed and evil and foreign and whatever. There is that kind of heritage. So going back to what I was saying about the 19th century, Christianity being white collar, you do see also Christians coming in at that time and doing all kinds of social renewal. So they build hospitals and they build schools. And of course, these things are popular.
Yes.
So some of these missionaries may have been more on the liberal end of things, but not necessarily. And these things kind of run through down to today. I mean, after the Second World War, you get another spike in conversions to Christianity. Japan has really kind of sort of feels it's lost its soul after the capitulation to the Allied forces. A lot of people spiritually searching. Lots of Protestant evangelical missionaries come in the late 40s, early 50s. There's a boom of conversions. But still, Japanese church, very small, it's never got over the 1%. Protestant evangelicals, 0.4%.
Wow.
I mean, that's supposed to be smaller than North Korea, according to Operation World. So you've got tiny, tiny church. And what do people think of Christianity? Well, it's a religion for clever people. It's broadly a good thing because schools and hospitals were a good thing. It's foreign, not Japanese. That's the general understanding. I think one thing that's different from my experience in the UK is that most people are broadly tolerant or accepting of Christianity up to a point. What I mean is we haven't had yet in Japan the kind of, well, if you're a conservative Christian, then you must be misogynist and you must be homophobic and I don't like you because you're trampling on my freedoms or whatever. You know, this kind of Western discourse doesn't happen here.
Okay.
So the pressure is not yet.
Right.
So that's interesting. I mean, there was one survey done a few years ago asking Japanese people, if you had to choose a religion, what religion would you choose? And 10% of Japanese people in that survey said Christianity.
Wow.
10% is much, much, much higher than, obviously, the number of people who are Christians.
Yes.
But that suggests that Christianity is more, got a better public perception than is translated into number of people who would call themselves adherents.
Mm. Does that suggest that, are there a lot of people in Japan who would call themselves agnostic or atheist? If it's this kind of, you could choose any religion, suggesting maybe they haven't already chosen one?
That's a really interesting question, because what is a religion? Okay, if you ask Japanese people, are you religious? Lots of people, I don't have statistics on that, but will say, no, I'm not religious. So the word for that is mushukyo, which means no religion. But if you ask Japanese people in surveys, are you Shinto? More than 70% of people will say yes.
Okay.
And if you ask them, are you Buddhist? I think it's 67% of people will say yes.
Wow.
So 70 plus 67. So Buddhism and Shinto don't say the same thing, okay? They have different worldviews and different teachings. And yet there's a sizable percentage of Japanese, probably most Japanese, because I would imagine that the 70% who say they're Shinto and the 67% who say they're Buddhist are probably quite a lot of overlap. So possibly most Japanese people would say that they identify with both of these religions, which to a Westerner, hang on a minute, these are different.
Right.
They teach different things, they come from different places. And this goes back to the story I told at the beginning.
Yes.
About Mr. Tanaka, the Shinto priest, because there's an inclination here to bring things together or build them on top of each other. And historically, that's precisely what happened. I mean, Shinto is the ancient animistic faith of Japanese people. Buddhism came in the 6th century. They came from China, and the leaders thought, this is good, you know, the Chinese court do it, they've got more power and prestige than we have, let's have it here as well.
So very pragmatic.
Well, it's very pragmatic, yes. And Christianity, some Japanese have tried to do the same with that too. But if we're faithful to Jesus Christ, we will need to oppose that.
Mm.
And that's the challenge.
Yeah, please talk more about that. As a white Scottish missionary in this very uniform society with a tendency to perhaps stack religious beliefs on one another.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go about sharing the gospel in that context?
Yeah, Lorraine, it's really, this is the stack of challenges, when you talk about stacking religions, the stack of challenges that face us over here. So how do we go about it? Well, I think we need to be loving and wise and speak the truth with love. There's an element to which we can appeal to a Christian witness that is transformative. And that is already something that is happening or can happen in Japan. So I've talked about the fact that Christianity has a leavening influence on society. People have a general good impression of it. What we need to do, though, is somehow connect these things to gospel truth. Because very often some of these sort of things like schools and hospitals and so on, they've been brought about by non-evangelical missionaries or non-evangelical church leaders. Maybe a couple ways in. So one is Japanese have, and probably are having more and more, a suspicion towards any kind of religion that seems dogmatic. This is not limited to Christianity. So in Japan, there are quite a lot of new religions. We would probably call them cults, a lot of them. Recently, the Moonies, the Unification Church,
mm-hmm.
Korean group, have been very much in the headlines over here because of their involvement in political donations to the Liberal Democratic Party, who are usually the party of government over here. So what we need to do is demonstrate how Christianity is not like these groups. And that can only really be done by people knowing Christians. One issue we have in Japan is that many Christians will not tell people that they're Christian. So I remember when I was serving in a church and I was working, helping the youth group. One of the ladies in the church was helping out, and she was a godly lady who came to church week by week and served and so on. I remember asking her, what do people in your company think about the fact that you're a Christian? And she said to me, nobody knows. And I thought, that's not uncommon here, I don't think. There's a real kind of separation between public and private.
Sure.
And church needs to be, for many people, kept out of the workplace. People are just not meeting Christians. So one of the big challenges is to get people to meet real believers. I think the second thing is conceptual. So just for example, going back to Mr. Tanaka, the Shinto priest, 8 million gods in Shinto. And we use the same word in the Bible to describe the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. Kami is the word. So what you've got to do is unpack a whole lot of baggage that comes with the word kami.
For sure.
And then refill it up with gospel truth. So my wife and I have often felt with Japanese friends when we're sharing the gospel with them, it's not a good idea to start in the gospels, because it's too easy for a Japanese person to come to the idea that maybe, yes, Jesus is God, but that he's just another God.
Right.
And until we can be clear that we're talking about the God who is the creator of heaven and earth, there's no equivalent in Japanese of a small g for a pagan God and a big G for for the true God. And then the word for sin, sumi, is the same as the word for crime. So it's all too easy for Japanese people to say, well, I'm not a sinner because I never committed a crime. We need to unpack biblically what is sin.
Hmm. Just to go along with the idea of sin.
Yeah.
We've very often heard that Japanese culture put a lot of emphasis on shame.
Yes.
And I wonder whether that comes into play in terms of having conversations with people about faith and about sin.
No, that's really good. So I think that's true. And it's often said, you know, the Western cultures are guilt-oriented and Eastern cultures are shame-oriented. I think there's traction there where we can say, as we unpack the stories in Genesis of the fall, we can talk about, you know, bringing dishonor
sure.
on your father and, you know, causing shame, and then Jesus bearing our shame and so on. There's ways in to do that. And when we share the gospel, what we're often trying to do is to use cultural concepts that are familiar to Japanese people in order to get gospel truth across. At the same time, I'm loath to let go of biblical concepts like justice, righteousness, and so on. Mm. These do feel very forensic and, you know, legal and Western and juridical concepts to many Japanese people. But they do in the West as well,
yes.
You know. And what we need to do is not jettison them, but unpack them and explain them. But they might not be the way in.
Right.
So I think you're right, Christy. You know, if we can find a way in through the lens of shame, we should take advantage of that and then build on that to broaden out a Christian worldview.
Mm.
One of the things we're trying to do at the moment is come up with a new sort of set of evangelistic resources, printed resources, that we can use in the Japanese context to get the gospel across in familiar cultural concepts.
Yes, can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, well, it's earlier on I mentioned the ideas of uchi and soto. So this is the inside-outside dynamic that's very much at the heart of Japanese social relationships. So what we're doing on our team is we've written and we're in the process of having designed and illustrated a little booklet, a 10-page booklet. It's kind of like a gospel evangelistic tool that goes through the Bible story, or if you like, the gospel story, using uchi and soto, inside and outside, as kind of lens for understanding the Bible story. So just to give an example, the fall into sin. So instead of talking about this as disobedience, we talk about how human beings have tried to push God out. And there's an uchi-soto dynamic
yes.
there. So putting themselves at the center. And then as Adam and Eve are cast out of Eden, they're driven out of uchi fellowship.
Nice.
Japanese people are pursuing uchi in that if there are various circles to which they belong, which constitute their kind of uchi experience, their experience of being inside and belonging, there's still a fear that comes along with that they might be kicked out of the circle. And this is why they're always looking
right.
side, right? Okay, well, you know, how do I make sure that I preserve my space? And one of the things we're trying to get at, the kind of art call that's there, is Japanese people are looking for kind of ultimate belonging. And what God is offering us in the gospel of Jesus Christ, in that sense, it's a homecoming. It's a welcome into heavenly mansions. It's a restoration of that uchi, inside fellowship, which we understand from scripture is constituted in the three persons of the Trinity in all eternity coming together in an inner fellowship, which then in love overflows to the creation of an outside world designed for this uchi fellowship. But then you've got humans breaking this, you see.
Right.
Of course, this goes on then to the story of Jesus Christ, who comes into the world, but then is cast out of the city. You know, the letter to the Hebrews talks about how he is taken out of the camp to bear the reproach of the people, sin of the people. So it's using these concepts to kind of bring Japanese friends along in the story to the point where they say, yeah, that is actually something that I feel existentially.
Right.
You know, I may not feel guilt because I'm not a criminal. Okay. Those things can come later. That's what we've been working on over the last few months here.
That's so exciting and a really beautiful way of telling the gospel truths, it sounds like. Thinking back to something else you said earlier, do you find that this whole idea that Christianity is a very intellectual religion, a religion where you need to be very clever in order to become a Christian, do you find that a barrier in gospel conversations? And are these sorts of resources maybe a way that you're kind of navigating that?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Could this just be that I'm an inadequate communicator? Very much so. You know, Japanese is my second language very much. But it seems to be an experience across the board. So the most common responses that Japanese friends have given me over the years when I try and share the gospel with them is they say, "Muzukashii," which means difficult. Mm. And I used to think that that meant, oh, what you're saying to me is difficult conceptually and I can't understand it. I now realize that that was a fairly naive interpretation, that when a Japanese person says "muzukashii" or difficult, what they really mean is, yeah, I kind of get what you're saying, but it would be complex for me to take this any further and apply it to my life.
Right. Okay.
So, yeah. Mm. But there is conceptual difficulty, I think, in getting across the key elements of the Christian faith. You know, when we talk about things that in Western culture, even for non-Christians, the idea, for example, of creation out of nothing, or
sure,
just the idea of monotheism, or the idea that God reveals himself in words and so on, these things are just not familiar, and it's harder to get them across. But yes, with the Uchisoda project, so the little booklet that we're making, 10 pages, and the top of each page is an illustration. We've got a professional designer who's working on that now. And we're also going to publish a manga.
Oh, brilliant.
Ooh, fascinating.
That's like a Japanese comic book.
Oh, I'd love to read that.
Oh, well, it's going to come out, Lord willing, in November or so this year. But it's 125 pages. And what that is written by my wife. She doesn't draw the manga. We've got a professional manga artist doing that. But it is a story of four characters who basically, a couple of them are Christians, a couple of them are non-Christians, but they work through the Uchisoto concepts. And the story develops where they are interacting about it, and I won't, you know, tell you what happens in the end, because otherwise you don't read the manga. And we hope to get an English version out of it one day as
that'd
well.
That'd be amazing.
But what it's based on, the manga story, it's based on real things that my wife, Yuko, and I, what she and I have heard real Japanese people say. So the characters say it in the story.
Okay, right.
But the words that they say, they're based on what real people have said as we've shared these Uchisoto ideas with them. So the main reason for the manga is for training purposes.
Okay,
Japan,
sure.
It may be an Asian thing across the board. I'm not sure. I've heard from others in Asian countries. But Japan is the church is pastor-centric.
Hmm.
The pastor is the one who does the evangelism. And if my friend's interested in the gospel, I bring him to the pastor. And most people, members of churches, including elders and officers, think they can't lead a Bible study. They wouldn't be equipped to do it. So the manga it's basically a manga of a Bible study. You know,
right.
It happens in cafe or whatever. So anyway, yeah, that's part of the project.
That sounds wonderful.
Since you mentioned Japanese churches being quite like pastor-centric and how that's different from maybe churches in the UK.
Yeah.
I wonder whether we can talk a little bit more about that, like about Japanese churches. Like how are Japanese churches different from churches in the West, and how much is, let's say, the Uchisoto mentality present in church communities in Japan?
Yeah. Well, first of all, how are they different? Typical Japanese church is small. I think the average size is 30 people, but there'll be churches that are significantly smaller than that.
Sure.
Typically led by one pastor without a staff team or anyone else helping. although there may be elected officers or whatever, depending on the church polity, typically very conservative socially. Many Japanese churches will continue to prefer only organ music or quite an old-fashioned atmosphere. And that often reflects the way that the missionaries who came and initially set up the churches showed them how to do it. Another aspect of that is Christians in Japan typically won't drink alcohol because the missionaries who came over and planted the churches told them not to do that. Churches in Japan tend to be quite somber. And what I mean by that is you'll go into the service and there might be a notice on the sheet or maybe even up on the screen saying, "We're about to worship God, please don't talk."
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it's very interesting. And I could talk for hours about this theologically, about why this has happened. I don't think it's just cultural. I think it's a different way of reading the scriptures that's very common in Japan, where Old Testament ideas of worship are typically applied more directly to New Testament worship than I have seen in some Western churches.
Fascinating.
Yeah, and you get this idea of pastor-centrism that I just mentioned. You know, both my sending churches in the UK will either baptize children or offer a dedication, depending on what parents want. That is completely unthinkable in a Japanese church. Completely unthinkable culturally.
Oh, wow.
Because there's no way that they could coexist like that. Japanese people would say to the pastor, "What do we do?" And everybody must do the same thing. There's no question of different people coming up with different ideas in church. So I find that interesting. And then you asked, Christy, about how the uchisoto thing works out in churches. So people are typically intensely loyal to their church. Actually, statistics suggest that if you're a Japanese person and you move to a Western country, or it may even be an Eastern country where there are lots of Christians, like South Korea or something, 30 times more likely to become a believer than if they stayed at home.
Wow.
But people who are converted overseas and go back, there's a huge dropout rate within 2 years of falling away, even when they've been baptized. And part of this is the uchisoto thing. So in the West, when Japanese people come over, we treat them as guests and we invite them for meals and we look after them. And then when they get back to Japan, they join a church, the pastor puts them on the toilet cleaning rota. And, you know, expects them to send ningajo, New Year greetings cards, to the other members of the church. And suddenly they've got all these new giri no kanke, so social obligations of being in an uchi. And this is why Japanese people in Japan, when they're converting to Christianity, it's as much of an interest to them to know about Jesus Christ as it is to know also about who are these people to whom I am committing very seriously the rest of my life. Japanese people typically take church membership more seriously than in the West, and it's not uncommon for, well, I've been part of a church where at the end of the year they'll award a prize to people who've been in the worship service 52 weeks of the year.
Oh, wow.
You know, for example, in the UK we'll have camps that carry on over the weekend and people will not be at church.
Right.
But in Japan, camps don't happen on Sundays. They'll always finish so that you can go back to church because that's your family. And there's good things about this.
Sure.
You know,
absolutely.
Coronavirus changed things, but they'll typically have lunch together, everybody together after the service every week.
That's lovely.
So yeah, those are some of the cultural differences.
If the churches are more like old-fashioned and smaller, how does it play out demographically? Are there young people in church? Are there mega churches or charismatic churches as the exceptions?
Yeah, well, the demographic in Japan generally is it's old and getting older.
Right.
The demographic in churches is very much a reflection of that. There are lots and lots of churches that have no young people at all. Japan has the worst female-to-male ratio in the world of church. So it's supposed to be 7-1.
Whoa.
So in the Japanese church. Yeah, but that doesn't mean that Japanese churches are filled with lots of young women. It's that women live significantly older than men, and there are more women anyway. And so there are lots of older women in churches.
Wow.
There are churches that are attracting lots of young people. There are charismatic and Pentecostal churches that are growing, particularly in the cities. And there are more traditional expressions of Christianity in the older denominations where, you know, they're introducing what they call over here, worship, but that's like guitar praise songs or whatever, worship songs. And just, you know, reflecting more of a sort of a youthful culture. So there's a range, but the general trend is for a greying church population, to which I'm contributing.
So, Richard, I just wonder, how can I, as your sister in Christ, and any of our listeners who are maybe around the world as part of the wider body of Christ, how can we love our Japanese brothers and sisters better? How can we love and serve people like you better, working in the Japanese context? What do we need to know? What can we be praying for? What would you say to us?
Thanks, Lorraine. Well, thanks for taking an interest in what God is doing in Japan. I guess it's part of the broader question of how churches that send missionaries and have partnerships with churches in other places partner effectively with them and what that looks like. As far as missionaries go, like us, yeah, don't put us on pedestals. We come back sometimes to the UK and there is a sense of, you know, oh, missionaries, wow. You know, we're just like other believers trying to be faithful and struggling and sinning as we go. It's important to remember that, and that'll help, you know, you to pray for us and also for our Japanese brothers and sisters over here.
Sure.
But I think also I'd want to say please recognize the spiritual battle and pray. You know, it's quite easy to come to Japan. You can come over here as an English teacher or as an engineer or in doing any number of things and work. And it's not difficult to come to Japan. And in many ways, Japan's a very pleasant and comfortable place to live, and you know, we're happy living here. But I think when a church takes the step of setting some people apart and putting them over on the other side of the world for the express purpose of helping to grow the kingdom of God and spread the gospel, or as I'm involved in theological education and developing resources and things, that's a little bit different. And it's helpful for churches to recognize that.
Yes.
You know, it's common these days to say everything's mission and everybody is involved in mission. There's a sense in which that's true. There's something I think about churches sending, and that's where we get the word missionary, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, there's a relationship there that goes two ways, but the sending part is kind of the key. And Satan doesn't like it.
Right.
It's about investing in the church. It's about churches partnering with each other and thinking, okay, the gospel is important. It's important enough that we're going to invest in these people and we're going to support them and send them. So yeah, don't put us on a pedestal, but do also remember that there are particular spiritual challenges to doing what we're doing.
Absolutely.
And missionaries are doing over here in Japan. It is harder, in my opinion, to be a Christian in Japan than it is to be a Christian in Britain. And I'm not speaking about me. I'm speaking about what I see, you know, my Japanese
sure.
brothers and sisters. They're in a minority. The pressure to conform is huge. There are lots of people who, sadly, you know, we talk about the returnees mentioned who fall away. That said, and I really want to end on a positive note because, you know, I can talk about the challenges, but we've got to remember that God is sovereign, that God has a love for the nations as well as a plan for the nations, that he's been doing things in the churches in Japan long before people like I got here, and he'll continue to do, Lord willing, long after I've gone. One of the values of the organization that we work with in Japan here in Nagoya, Christ Bible Institute, is partnering with the existing church. And missionaries don't always do that.
Right.
There's sometimes a temptation to come in and say, you know, you guys are not doing it properly. You know, we'll kind of show you what to do. But what we have come to see is that, you know, it might not necessarily be the way we would do things or whatever, but that God has been at work in this country, particularly through Protestant evangelical missionaries for 170 years or whatever now, 160 years.
That's wonderful.
And we're just playing a little part in that. By most calculations, there are up towards 1 million Christians in this country. And we look and kind of pray for the day when there will be a revival. And we shouldn't think that these things are impossible. You know, we look at other East Asian countries like South Korea, where, you know, it's a very big and vibrant evangelical church. And culturally, in many ways, not that different from Japan. Yeah, we're sowing seed, but we're in it for the long term. Really, it really has to be. You know, there are signs of great challenges to come, but God is sovereign. We wait and see what he'll do.
Amen. Thank you so much, Richard. It's been so good to get a glimpse into your life in Nagoya and the church in Japan. It gives us lots to pray for, lots to give thanks to God for, and we just really appreciate you coming on our podcast today.
Thanks very much for having me both. It's been good fun.
Very welcome. Thanks again. To all of our listeners, thank you for joining us as well, and we'll hope to see you again soon.
Thanks for tuning into the Overtones podcast today. Make sure to subscribe and tune in to the next episode on your streaming platform of choice.
Follow us and share our podcast with your friends on Facebook and Instagram. You can find us on both platforms as Overtones Think Tank.
And if you'd like to get in touch with feedback, comments, or other ideas, our email address is podcast@overtonesproject.com. See you next week.